Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, I don't know what happened to our sunshine, but I hope we've got some coming back because it's, since it's only the end of August here. We're still celebrating our fourth year on air this month. Why not? We thought we'd milk it this month. Coming up later in the show, I'm going to be talking with Andrew Gross, who had five number one New York Times bestseller hits when he co-authored with James Patterson. Since then, Andrew's written solo several books and has had his own New York Times bestsellers, including The Dark Tide. And it was also awarded the International Thriller Writers Award. And he's going to be joining us later in today's show. But first of all, if you've been waiting for that new job, or you've been waiting to lose weight, you've been waiting for your husband to shape up or your wife to shape up or your kids to ship out, you'll want to stay tuned and listen to what our first guest today has to say. Kristen Moller is a self-declared addict, a self-declared self-help junkie, and she's going to tell us how to stop waiting and start living and loving our lives immediately. First of all, I just want to say, since I mentioned our fourth year on air anniversary again, I want to just say a huge thank you to you. I did not expect this, to get emails from you congratulating us, and I really appreciate it. I appreciate it very much, and I especially appreciate it. The little package I had from Carla S., she actually mailed me a box of chocolates. She must know me well.
That's fantastic.
So I just wanted to say thanks to everyone who did that. I also, of course, want to say thanks to Eric because he's off on vacation for a couple of weeks starting tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But we could not have done this without you. We are a team, and I sincerely appreciate everything that you've done and continue to do for us and the show.
Oh, thank you. And, I got to say, it's a big source of pride in my radio career to be associated with this show. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And I want
now, where's my chocolates?
You know what? I ate them all.
That's all right.
We did a show with Tosca Arena about eating clean and eating healthy, and I was doing extremely well. And then these lovely chocolates arrived, and I thought, well, it would be rude of me not to eat them because a listener sent them. and they just happened to be my favorites, coffee creams.
Oh, wonderful.
So quickly tell us where you're going on vacation. You're going to some of my favorite places.
Yeah, I'm going to Paris
for
the first time in ages and ages. So, we recently had a show where there was a guest that was talking about actually going to Paris. And, that kind of germinated in my mind. And as it turned out, there was a big sale on fares to Paris this year, thankfully, because Air France started doing nonstop flights from SeaTac to Paris.
Oh, cool.
To Charles de Gaulle. So, so hopped on that and very excited. And of course, I've got some friends in London, so I'm going to go see them and going to go see a band that I adore called Pulp that got back together and are doing a small tour. And so I'll finally get to see them live. So I'm excited about that. And I'm probably going to head up to Scotland and see Glasgow and Edinburgh, as the Scots
say. I don't know about Glasgow so much, but I don't want to offend anyone who's from Glasgow. My sister-in-law is from Glasgow.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
really?
And there are some beautiful areas around Glasgow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Edinburgh is gorgeous, but Glasgow, I think, is a really thriving city, so I kind of wanted to just check out the pulse of, get the energy.
Yeah, and you know what? To be fair, it's 30 plus years since I've been there, and I do know it's changed a lot.
Well, cool. Well, we'll see. I'm not planning to spend that much time, but just want to check it out. And I think we'll maybe end up down south in Brighton, see the seaside, the English Riviera, as they call it.
Yeah, I do not know why they call Brighton the English Riviera. Here I am, slamming my own country, but I don't know why they call Brighton the English Riviera. They're at Cornish Riviera. Yes, I can see that.
Well, but Devon, I guess the Devon area is supposed to be.
Devon's beautiful. Yeah, Devon is beautiful.
We'll see where we end up. I haven't got it all hammered out. I kind of like to go and fly a little bit by the seat of my pants and kind of plan things while we're there just so we can be flexible, you know, because people will say, well, what you should do is you should come with me and we'll go to this, you know. And it's like, if you've got everything hammered out and hotels booked and everything, you can't really be that flexible. So I kind of like to be a little flexible. So we'll see.
Yeah.
I'll have to give you a recap when I get back. But
you know what? And it's people have told me, oh, don't go to such and such place. I go anyway. And, you know, because you get your own kick from it and your own enjoyment and see it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think you will see things differently when you've actually been raised somewhere.
Of course.
But yeah, that's really exciting. And I'm really pleased for you.
Thank you.
And we're going to have our guest on in just a moment. Before we do that, I just want to say that, you know, since we're starting our fifth year on air, if you have particular guests that you would like to hear on the show, if you have ideas for topics that you'd like coming up to hear as well, then please do email me. You can email me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, and we're happy to take that on board. And also, if you know, years ago I used to write a feature series on inspirational women for a local newspaper, and I can't tell you how many times those stories have been, I've sold them to, even overseas, I've resold those stories. People are always interested, I think, in inspirational people. So if you know of an inspirational woman or man, doesn't have to be female, who's overcome adversity or totally changed their life, is making a big difference in the lives of others, then please do let me know, because we'd love to have them on the show and profile them and share their journey with you. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by my first guest, Christine Moller. Her book is called Waiting for Jack, and this is going to be an interesting conversation. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
You're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, my first guest today is best-selling author, spokesperson, personal coach, national speaker, and popular radio show host, Christine Moller. She received her master's degree in mental health counseling from Nova Southeastern University in Florida and has been a personal development professional for over 20 years. She has a very interesting story to share with us today. Let's bring her straight on. Christine Moller, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here today.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your book, because I think no matter how, how well read we are or how well versed in making changes in our life, I think most of us at some time fall into that trap of waiting, waiting for something whether it's you know, more money or a different situation or somebody else to participate. And your book was very timely for me because it hit the nail on the head. But I want to talk about a little bit of your background, and I just want to let listeners know if you can hear a little clicking going on. Kristen is calling in from Colorado today, and there are some pretty major storms going on in the area, and her phone keeps clicking. But hopefully we can get through this. So I want to go back, Kristen, to talk about when you first discovered your passion for personal development. Go back to your childhood and tell us what led up to this, because you had, at a very young age, you started realizing that a one way of avoiding failure was simply not to try.
Mm. Yes, not to try, and even to really kind of injure myself through developing the eating disorder. But yes, I think like many of us, I know we all have things that happen in our childhood that really do shape and form us. And for me, I maybe particularly prone, you know, sensitive, a very sensitive child, and parents divorced when I was 7, moved around a lot, started new schools, and it was back and forth between small town New England out in the country and Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which are two extremes, and I know there are more extremes than that, but they were pretty extreme for me. And so every time I would go to a new school, I would have trouble fitting in. And even though, you know, on the outside things looked okay, on the inside I just would feel completely self-conscious and just really horrified. And I kept getting the clothes wrong every time I would go to a new school. And as a young girl, it's very important to have the right clothes. And I just didn't quite a few times. And
well, because there's a huge difference between Florida and Massachusetts and style and what's considered right and wrong. Yeah.
And how is one to know? You know, these are the days before. I mean, if we had had Facebook in the day, I probably could have maybe been a little more on top of things. But, you know, this was a long time ago.
Right.
So kept getting it wrong and then started focusing on my appearance more and more and more, which then led me to the irrational belief that I needed to go on a diet. And I went on a starvation diet and started losing weight, and people commented. I got some attention, and that began this seeking of something outside of myself and thinking I didn't have it, and which developed into 7 years of struggling with bulimia and alcohol and drug abuse.
Yeah. And I think that's a feeling that many people struggle with, that feeling of not fitting in, not quite belonging, even if they don't, you know, end up with a disorder. So you went eventually, you sought treatment, you went through a 12-step program, and you transferred that addiction, bulimia and all of that, into what you call, you became a self-help junkie.
Yes.
So, and you said, and I Googled this for myself, I found like over 150, 150,000 self-help books on Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Just by typing in, you know, self-help books. And so that should tell us something there. So tell us how that transference affected you.
You know, and that's it's really what I'm doing is putting myself out as an example. And obviously by the subtitle of my book, Confessions of a Self-Help Junkie, I'm bringing some play to a topic to try to have the kind of raise awareness of a trap we can fall into. You know, and somewhere in the book I do say something like, I think it's in the very beginning, I say, well, is this a bad thing? Well, only if you consider seeking and never allowing yourself to find and never allowing yourself to rest and all of that, you know, it becomes that kind of pattern. So, you know, it's part of my life, and I am a practitioner in that field. So I'm at the same time, I'm bashing something, but I'm also of that thing, you know, and
right.
Without the learning that I have had over the past almost 22 years, I wouldn't be where I am, you know, so I'm eternally grateful to that field. And there are many of us that will continue seeking and just never, ever, ever be satisfied. And it becomes a compulsion. It becomes something that is a driving force for perfection, for this unattainable type of perfection. And it, you know, that the eating disorder was all about that, and it's part of it. I mean, it's not all of it, but it's like the whole focus on appearance, and if only I were thinner, then I would be okay, and if I had the right clothes, etc. And the self-help piece is like, you know, if I find the right teacher, if I find the right mentor, if I take the right course, well, maybe this course wasn't it. Maybe that course will be it. Maybe the next book I read. And we just never let ourselves settle in. And that's there's nothing wrong with being a seeker. And I do find this is something that's on a continuum, that some of us just go too far to the other extreme, and therefore, yeah, the whole self-help junkie.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this as I read it, and because a lot of people do constantly seek. I'm somebody who likes to constantly learn and grow, but I think that comes from just general interest and wanting that challenge and growth rather than feeling something's lacking. And that's where it can be a problem, isn't it, if you're trying to fill that hole with all
yes.
of this stuff.
Well, yeah, and it's like, first of all, even to think there is one, you know, that really, because the bottom line is we think something's wrong with us.
Yeah.
And then we're trying to fill it with anything. And for those of us that are addicts and, you know, have that nature, then that's really what it's all about, you know. And so, of course, I would then throw myself into, I'm going to be perfect on this end. I will never, you know, I always feel joyful, empowered, alive, excited, and anything that's not that means there's something wrong and I should fix that, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And you have a great little giveaway on your website. It's a free report for listeners who want to jump on there and download it. But on there you say that how do we know if we're actually waiting versus we're being introspective and thinking? And there are some things on there pointers on there that you give. I wonder if we could talk about that a little.
Definitely. Yeah, and that's, you know, again, this is something I wish there were just conclusive rules that we could always follow and always know, am I? You know, and so it comes back to the first thing I say to people is look for yourself. I mean, on some level we know, you know, and that I think the article, I can't remember if it says this on the website or my original article I wrote, is how to tell if you're being patient or being a chicken.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, and it's just, it becomes that continuum again. So the first thing I do is I look, and I can really tell, am I feeling some anxiety? Am I trying to avoid something? Is it, you know, is it that I just, you know those feelings when you mm-hmm. get something comes in your mind that you know you said you'd do something about, but it's a little bit challenging. And it's not like when we have those thoughts that we kind of go, there's this almost like internal shielding where we go, ooh, don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, good indication that you're putting something off. That's not patience. You know, waiting, the way I define it, is distinct from patience. And it's that hesitation to stretch ourselves. It's that fear of being embarrassed or humiliated or, you know, something coming up from our past that we don't like. It's, you know, not wanting to put ourselves out there.
Yeah.
And we know that it's something we've said we want to do. And that's the other piece, too, because sometimes so many people ask me about writing books these days. And, of course, and I coach authors now, which I love. But one thing I really ask people to look at is it a should or is it really your heart's desire? Because there's so often we have this thing that sounds like a good idea. And, like, I have a perfect example. I thought I should be a pilot. I should get my pilot's license because my family is full of pilots. My mother was a pilot.
I read your mother didn't. She had her first flying lesson at 40, and by 56 she was a captain.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just this brilliant, exciting thing. And I do have about 8 or 10 hours of flying time. And I thought, how cool would that be to say I'm a pilot? But what I realized after a while is it was the saying of it versus the actual doing of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like that with major things. So if you really, it's easy to just say, yeah, I want to write a book. Yeah, I want to be a pilot. But if we're not taking action, you can look at, are you just afraid and that's why you're not taking action? Or is it maybe that you really just don't want to, but
yes.
you just think you're supposed to want to?
Yes. And I have a story that I'll share in just a minute myself on that. We have to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Kristen Moller. Her new book is called Waiting for Jack, Confessions of a Self-Help Junkie, How to Stop Waiting and Start Living Your Life. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Coming up Labor Day on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We'll visit again with Northwest organic farmer Kurt Timmermeister, producer of the award-winning Dinish cheese and author of Growing a Farmer. Vicki also talks about the power of your past with John Schuster, who says the power of now is good, but it's the power of your past that gives you a sense of identity, potential, and direction.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is my guest in this segment is Kristen Mullett. Her book is Waiting for Jack. And why don't you tell us, tell us why it was called Waiting for Jack, first of all, and then I'm going to share my little story with you.
Okay. Well, Waiting for Jack. Waiting for Jack is a metaphor, and literally I was waiting for Jack. Jack being Jack Canfield, Chicken Soup for the Soul. Very quick version of the story is I had the opportunity to see him speak in an audience of 800 people. He held up a $100 bill to this audience, said, "Who wants this?" I jumped up out of my chair, ran up on stage, and grabbed it out of his hand. And this is one of the places I point to, not waiting, you know, as an example. If I had waited, all of the stuff that I'm about to share with you would not have happened, and I wouldn't be here talking to you today. So instead, I took action, ran up, grabbed it out of his hand, then, being bold still, asked for his personal email address. And he gave it to me, and he was kind of, you know, a hero mentor of mine for a while at a distance, and now all of a sudden I had this connection with him via email, and over a period of time I would send him these lengthy letters about my life and dreams and what I was creating, and he would always write me back. And then about 6 months went by, and what happens for many of us is inspiration fades, and my inspiration faded. I stopped emailing him, and some more time went by, and this puts us now January of 2008, and I thought, well, I'll get back in touch with Jack. I'll get that excitement again. I'll get that inspiration again. So I sent him an email, didn't hear from him, sent him another email, didn't hear from him, started to get worried, and started to really, really get obsessed with checking my email and was doing the compulsive send, receive. Yes, in the middle of a birthday celebration, celebrating my dad's 70th birthday, I was sneaking in my room to check my email, and I had an epiphany. Stopped me dead in my tracks, thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? And then I thought, why am I waiting? And then I thought, why am I waiting for Jack? And it was like lightning bolt, waiting for Jack. I'm going to write a book called Waiting for Jack, all about why we wait in life and why we continuously seek and search outside of ourselves for answers.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, my story is that I was, really frustrated at work. I really wanted to leave and move on to something new. And, you know, the next step level for me would have been to be CEO of a financial institution. And I just felt that it was just going to be more of the same. So I took my real estate license, took my stockbroker's license, I took my Blue Sky Security Law license so I could practice and sell securities. And I interviewed with all of the major houses, had three major offers, couldn't decide. I kept hedging, but this was a case of where I wasn't being chicken. Something inside of me, every morning I'd wake up and I'd try and imagine myself getting into the office at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, checking the market, reading the Wall Street Journal, getting out my call list of 200 cold calls, and I just couldn't get excited about it. And so I went on vacation, and I was horse riding on a beach. And as I, in the middle of that horse ride, I don't know what happened, but I just had this epiphany, like, I just can't do this. I don't want to do it. And so I think that's a good example there of where you're just where something is inside of you telling you this isn't right for you, don't do it, because it's just more of the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and then if you didn't stop and actually listen to that and clear yourself enough to really listen, then yeah, we pick up the wrong messages or do things that don't serve us and all of that. So exactly.
Yeah. So I want to talk about becoming a fierce disruptor of the ordinary. How do we, you know, we put all of these excuses and blocks in our way. How do we start disrupting some of that?
Yeah, that's, well, of course, one of my favorite topics. So, yes. And first, you know, I want to define what it's being a fierce disruption of the ordinary. And I'll define that, you know, it, first of all, fierce is obviously fierce. It's powerful. It's passion. It's enthusiasm, all of that. And disruption really means interruption of what's usual. So it's a change. It's a state change. And when I'm talking about ordinary here, I'm not bashing the ordinary, because there's, you know, there's whole appreciation of the simple moments. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about when we are complacent, when we settle for the status quo, when we are predictable, when we've kind of just sunken into basically being asleep at the wheel. So it really is, it's a way of being, and it's internal too, and that's the thing too. It's really easy to point our fingers and say, okay, it's ordinary out there in the world, or that person's behavior is ordinary, and I'm going to disrupt that, really, you know, make it wrong or be discouraged about it. It really comes to what can we do, who can we be? So it's a movement. It's something, it's a new way of thinking, acting, and living. And it comes, it's whatever is ordinary for the individual. So it would have been ordinary for me that day to sit in my chair and see Jack Canfield hold up a $100 bill and be stopped by my fear of being humiliated, because I didn't know if I was about to be humiliated and, you know, jump up on stage and grab a $100 bill out of his hand and be hauled off stage, you know, and thrown in jail. I mean, that was a possibility. But it would have been ordinary for me to listen to my fear and just stay put. It'd be ordinary for when I was writing my book to, I never viewed myself to be a writer. So it would have been ordinary to just stick with that view and not actually do it. So it's the thing that stops us from living the life we say we want to live and living fully. That's the ordinary piece that I'm talking about disrupting. And sometimes it needs something fierce. It's like, you know, sometimes it's that something will shock us into being awake, you know, and oftentimes people get wake-up calls in their lives, whether it's an accident or, you know, someone they love dying or an illness or something like that, and that's a fierce disruption for sure. And what I'm saying is, let's learn how to interrupt, forcefully interrupt the patterns that will keep us asleep and not living our potential.
Yeah, and as you said, that's going to be totally different for everybody, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, really important to keep it about ourselves, you know?
Yes, yes. You talk about this in the book, Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love book. She describes in there the heartbreaking inability most people, or she describes the human condition, I should say, as the heartbreaking inability to sustain contentment.
Yes.
Why do you think so many people, that's true for so many people?
Yes, I think that is the tragedy of the human condition. It really is. It goes back to that seeking and searching of we decide at some point that there's something wrong with us, and we've gathered evidence throughout our lives and from, again, back to childhood and incidents that people have happened, you know, being picked last for a team or being made fun of or tripping and falling down in front of the class or getting something wrong, something like that. All these, you know, parents divorced, whatever it is. Like all these things, we go through life gathering evidence that something's wrong with us. And many of us have that, we become conscious of that fact, and many people still just are run by all of that. And then there's just this basic dissatisfaction for who we are. And it's, you know, it's nice to hear that I'm not the only one, you know. There's so many people that describe that feeling of just going through life dissatisfied and thinking, I've got to fix this, I've got to change that. And so I think it is, you know, there can be a motivator in there too, because if I didn't have, when I was in my addictions, if there wasn't some knowing that something could be different, then I would never have changed. There was something calling me to something higher, something, you know, wholeness and recovery. And I listened to that and I followed it. And then again, here we are back on the scale. We can take that, continue that, and never, ever, ever be satisfied. I mean, you hear it, you know, it's why eating disorders are so prevalent, you know, addictions. I mean, the most successful people that have it seem like they have it all. You know, the movie stars we hear about, the musicians, you know, I mean, Amy Winehouse, seem like, I mean, the talent she had, the exquisite talent, but and she was an addict, truly, and that's an exaggerated form of what we're talking about. It's an exaggerated form of that dissatisfaction with who we are.
Mm. So many people that I've worked with over the last 2 or 3 years with all the financial crisis going on blame Seattle because that's where we're at. They blame Seattle. And, you know, have a tendency to want to think if they move back home or they move here or wherever, things are going to be different. Now, I've moved, you know, several thousand miles throughout the course of my life. And the one thing, the one common denominator is yourself. You always take yourself with you. So you talk in the book about the geographical cure. I wonder if you'd talk about that a little.
Yes, that's a good one, too. You know, kind of continuing on the theme of it's just life will be better if when there was someone wrote a book. I forget the author's name, but it's life would be different. No, life would be different if I lived in that house or something like that. My life would be perfect if I lived in that house. You know, it's this, again, this common this thing where we think, I know if I lived in Hawaii, really, everything would be OK. I mean, I'm positive. You know, I'd be more spiritual. I'd be more peaceful. I would never be rude to anyone. I would always be satisfied because it would be Hawaii after all. And then just like you said, we go to Hawaii and live there and then find that, oops, you know, and after the novelty wears off, it's like, oh, I'm there too, aren't I? And just to realize that we are the common factor. And that's, again, another way to, I mean, that's true in location. It's true in relationships. You know, it's kind of like if you keep getting into the same relationship over and over again, you got to kind of start to look. Okay.
Right.
Where is the source, you know?
So if we have these self-destructive behaviors, because ultimately that's what they are, why do we keep repeating them?
That is the, again, I wish. I think that is, like, well, it's one of the best explanations, Elizabeth Gilbert, which is why I quote that, you know, the whatever we said it was, the tragic fate of is to not accept the human condition. That's it. And it seems to be part of our makeup. And I could speculate, and I think it really is back to, it's just kind of what we do. And there's a wonderful new, I don't know how new it is because I don't have TV, but now I'm watching it on Netflix, the series Mad Men.
Oh, yeah.
About the ad men. And it's one, I just watched the first and second episode last night, and it's talking about we are told how to feel. We're surrounded by billboards, by media, by magazines, by advertisements on TV. All of these things we're told how to feel. And we always need something new, something better, something prettier, a new car, new outfit, you know, to be in Hawaii. We're told all of these things. We're fed it. It's in our culture and our society to think that we are not okay the way we are, and then we need something else, and we buy into it. And that's why it really comes down to, and that's why there is the self-help industry, to help us stop doing this, which can then, of course, as we're talking about, be another crutch. But it is an opportunity to stop and say, you know what, enough. And that's what some of my favorite teachers are, the ones that just say, enough, stop, now,
yes,
stop,
yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Stop.
Well, you have a quote in here, which I don't think I can find right now, but it's a quote on Buddhism, Steve Hagen.
Yes.
And he basically says, you know, at the end of the day, when we've checked everything off, we find we already had everything we needed.
Yes.
How did you turn yourself around? How did this transfer go for you?
Well, that's, you know, an excellent question. I think, too, was not an overnight, because I've had, as they say in 12-step programs, this is another perfect explanation of why we are the way we are. We have a built-in forgetter, and I love that. I mean, it, you know, just makes it really simple. We have a built-in forgetter. So I am someone who, this has been a process of evolution, of realizing, I mean, I would love to say to you that day I caught myself waiting for Jack and had the epiphany and then started writing this book, that everything changed and I never looked back and I never doubted myself and I never caught myself waiting again. And that would not be true, you know?
Right,
so
right.
I think I'm here to continue to point out to people that it's okay. And it's just a matter of catch yourself and come back. Catch yourself and come back. And I'm in this field, as I said, I'm on a path, I'm on a journey, and I'm committed to remembering as much as I can. And really, you know, when you talk about what is awakening, what is spiritual awakening, it's really is knowing who we really are.
Mm-hmm.
And for so many of us, we're interested in that journey, and we don't stay there all the time. We forget who we are. We forget our beauty, and we forget you know, all of that, that we're connected, and it's just a matter of coming back. So I'm committed to that journey, and so I just practice. I practice, and yeah. I allow my humanity.
And I think that's a key point is practice,
yeah.
practice, because we practiced, worrying, and we practiced fearing failure, and we practiced all
do.
This negative stuff, and we think that the if we try and flip that around, it should be an instantaneous solution. It's not going to be.
No, and bless the people that it is, really. I mean, for people that have that just have a transformation and it sticks, I haven't met too many of them, and you know, I know they probably exist, but when you read a lot of the spiritual masters who are really willing to talk about it, they all talk about humanity, and it just doesn't, I mean, we have our ego, we have our brain wired the way it's wired for a reason. It kept us safe. It still does. You know, we need those functions. And so we're working against some wiring, and then all of, you know, centuries and thousands and years and all of that, and all the media that we talked about before and all these influences. So we're dealing with all of that.
Right, right. At the end of the book, you share six principles. And principle number four, you say inspiration is an inner phenomenon. Many people turn outward for inspiration. Tell us what you mean by it's an inner phenomenon.
Yes. What I mean is I, too, get inspired by things outside. A beautiful sunset, a piece of music, something, watching two human beings come together and express love, you know, things like that. I mean, I'm moved by all of those things as well. But what happens is that that moment happens, and then that moment is gone. And then what is left is our memory of it, the sensation, all of that. And then that fades too. And so what happens is we will then often attribute, oh, I need another one. You know, I need another inspiring moment to be inspired. And we forget that we actually cultivated all the reaction to those events is internal. And so that's where it really is. That's where it happens, because not everybody gets inspired by the same things. So it happens internally, and then it's up to us, if we want to keep present to something, to continue it. And it's kind of like, of course, back to the example of writing a book. You know, you could be inspired to write a book, and it's a really, you know, like fiery, amazing feeling. That will fade. You know, anything
right.
that's big, it will go away. So then where, you know, are we going to just continue to look outside and say, it's gone, forget it, or are we going to generate it for ourselves?
Right, right. You also say support with action. Support your inspiration with action. This is the key thing that I think a lot of people stall on.
Yes.
So I want to know, first of all, I found the quote by Buddhism. I just wanted to share that because it says, there's nothing to prove, nothing to figure out, nothing to get, nothing to understand. When we finally stop explaining everything to ourselves, we may discover that in silence, complete understanding was here all along. And you share that in your book.
Yes.
Why was it important for you to share that with us?
You know, I mean, to me, that's just it. I mean, really, it's here all along. It's here all along. What we're looking for is actually here. We already are that right now. Everything really is okay right now. Everything, we are okay right now. And if we started there, if we really got that and started there, you know, then it's like we can live fully and really know who we are, and then know, and then from there, if there are things out there in the world, because it'd be easy to say, you know, like hear what I'm saying and think, well, there's stuff that's wrong in the world. Well, okay, but we could then from a place of wholeness go and do something about that versus like a place of reaction and fear, you know, and it just really is the what we are searching for, we already are.
Yeah. And one of the questions at the end of your book is, you know, how do you want to be remembered? I think that's a very key thing to think about when we're talking about all of this. You talk about unconditional love. I wonder if you just tell us what you've learned about that, and then we'll be right at the end of our segment.
Oh, my goodness. Well, okay, very quickly. Yes, what have I learned about that? Oh, my gosh. Well, it's just, you know, love, it's that basic thing. We can just so easily say those words, love without conditions, unconditional love. But it really is kind of like, I talk about disrupting the ordinary and loving ourselves and accepting ourselves. But if we're not turning that around and doing that for others too, and developing compassion and having compassion in the, you know, and if we're all going to react and we're all going to get our feelings hurt, and we're going to, you know, sometimes not be in unconditional love. But coming back to that, you know, it's like, being willing to grant other people space to be human and to know that they've got stuff going on too. We have no idea. And that can be from people that aren't even, you know, the person that cuts us off in traffic to your mate, to your spouse. And it's hard to practice. I mean, I put conditions on all the time and then I take them back off.
Well, again, I think it's that word practice we need to focus on.
Yes.
Practice makes perfect,
practice.
As they said. Well, what would you like to leave our listeners with a final thought today, Kristen?
You know, one of the other principles in the book is simple actions can lead to extraordinary results. And I think it's just a matter of people realizing, just take one small action towards something you're dreaming about, that you care about, towards something you've always said you wanted to do, or, you know, whatever it is, a simple action. You never know where a simple action can lead. And yes, it was a bold action when I grabbed that $100 bill, but it was also something simple, and it altered the course of my life. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know where that was going to go, but it did completely shift something. And so just one little action today towards something you care about is what I would like to leave people with.
Yeah, absolutely, because that well could have been a very, very well missed opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah. And where can listeners find out more about you, Kristen?
Well, I would love to have people go to waitingforjack.com because it's probably the easiest one to spell and remember. So Waiting for Jack is the title of the book that's all spelled out, and links to everything Kristen Moeller are on that page and more about the book and all of that. So
okay, and there's a couple of free downloads on there, including the What Are You Waiting For? How to Determine If You're Being Patient or Simply Being a Chicken.
Yes.
So I thank you so much for being with us. You are very inspirational. You're doing great work. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You too. It's my pleasure.
And again, you can find more about Kristen Moeller at waitingforjack.com. And her book is called Waiting for Jack, Confessions of a Self-Help Junkie, How to Stop Waiting and Start Living Your Life. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by New York Times bestselling author Andrew Gross. Listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. But it's
welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, today is just whizzing by. My next guest is Andrew Gross. He's the author of New York Times and international bestsellers The Blue Zone, Don't Look Twice, Reckless, and The Dark Tide, which was nominated for the Best Thriller of the Year award by the International Thriller Writers. He's also co-author of 5 number one bestsellers with James Patterson, including Judge and Jury and Lifeguard. Andrew Gross, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. Whizzing is the appropriate word since we just had a hurricane blow over our house the other day.
Whereabouts are you?
Just out of New York. And actually, it was a little more, with less wind and a lot of rain, and not so much a hurricane, but anyway.
I have a good friend who's actually moving to New York. She was supposed to fly out there today. All her furniture went on ahead and her car, and she's stuck here until she can get a plane out there.
Well, I'm sure she knows that having an earthquake and a hurricane and a tornado warning in 1 week is rather rare, even for us. So.
Yes, yes, anyway. Yeah. She is not worried. Well, I'm pleased to have you on the the show. I personally like to read thrillers, and this was certainly a thrill ride. Nelson DeMille wrote on the front of your book, "This book should be read with the lights on and the door closed, a rare and menacing psychological thriller that works on every level." And of course, your book is called Eyes Wide Open. This was a little detour from you, from your regular series. Uh-huh. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's a much more personal book for me, and since you've looked through, I think you know that it's really about two events from my own life, real life events, and one of them about a year and a half ago was the suicide of my young nephew, who was a very troubled kid, bipolar, schizophrenic, and was found at the bottom of a landmark cliff in California. And then years before, when I was a teenager, I had this chance encounter with this sort of gaunt, straggly-haired guy who ended up becoming synonymous with sort of barbaric murder, Charlie Manson. Mm. So I had always wanted to put that scene somewhere in a book, and, you know, even though this book is hardly about Manson or a Manson-like figure, it does sort of have a way of creeping in there.
Right. So I want to just go back as well to your beginnings, because you haven't always been a writer, and I'm always interested in how people got mm-hmm. from A to B, and you do talk about this on your website, because you said you did major in English, but you actually went into women's clothing. So tell
us. I'm probably, well, actually, there are a couple. I've found out a handful of people who actually share this background, but it's a small list of people who are sort of become semi-successful thriller writers or writers in general who have this, I always sort of say I apprentice for writing about crime by spending 20 years in the women's apparel business. So, you know, my family had a large company, actually, and I did get an MBA from Columbia after I graduated school and put aside any thoughts I had at the time of writing and spent close to 20 years either in that firm or actually I branched out and I got involved in a bunch of ski companies, ski clothing companies, and tennis clothing companies in the 80s when that actually was a viable business. And when one of them became no longer viable, it sort of hastened a second career for me, which was writing these page-turners.
Now, had you always thought in your head that one day, because our first segment was about waiting, you know, until one day.
Yeah.
Had you always thought in your head, one day I'll be a writer?
I think I had in my head that one day I would write a novel. I never thought that I would make a career of it. It was sort of a bucket list kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And like everybody says, you know, I want to tick it off. And one day, you know, first of all, I think everybody does have a book in them, which I always encourage people to write it, even if it's only to put down their own family stories. But in my case, I never, ever thought, I mean, I think at this point I've written 12, you know, in 12 years, and I've probably been doing this longer than I've stayed at one thing ever in my life, and I would never have imagined that I'd ever be saying that.
Right, right. Now, this was kind of serendipitous for you, how you started. As you said, there was a turnaround situation at work which hastened your writing career, mm-hmm. but you submitted a manuscript to an editor. And she gave it to, as I understand it, to James Patterson, who's been around forever.
Right, but he wasn't then.
Oh, he wasn't then. Okay.
Yeah, he hadn't even had. Well, I was going to say he hadn't. He hadn't had a number one book at that point. I was the first guy that he paired up with, and it was really fortuitous because when you talk, you know, I'm a great believer that sort of having been in some successful business environments and some semi-successful writing environments, and everyone always sort of thinks it's all about them, but I'm a strong believer in the degree to which luck and good fortune play in a lot of careers, and certainly in my career, I had written this book that just didn't make the cut, got close, found myself a fancy agent, got it, put it in front of a couple of dozen publishers. Everyone was thinking it was going to be a big book, and like a lot of books, it just wasn't. It didn't sell. And I was literally sitting around our den, like, wondering what cliff I was going to drive our car off of, you know, when I got a call out of the blue from Jim Patterson. And it was one of those sort of moments that's so serendipitous that if I put it in a book, everyone would strike it out and just say, come on, that stuff doesn't happen, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In my case, it did.
Well, and
we
say,
ended up doing actually 6 books together. So yeah.
And 5 of those were number one New York Times
bestsellers. Yeah, they all were actually in 6.
Yeah. I'm 6
sort
too.
Of moot
yeah.
about the 6, but I did one of them. They all went to number one. So actually, I was a guy that had all these number one bestsellers behind me, and I'd never had my name in print for one word on my own, you know. And so when I finally sort of had an idea for a book I wanted to write on my own called The Blue Zone, and actually I only put it in outline form and sort of threw it out. I didn't even have an agent. Threw it out. Found the one agent that I wanted to have in about 2 minutes. The first time around, it took me 2 years to get anybody to want to pair up with me. The second time around, it took me about 2 minutes. And within a week, I had 5 people bidding on it, on this outline. So it just shows you, you know, it shows you the difference. It shows you what teaming up with Patterson for 6 books will do.
Well, and as you pointed out, he hadn't had a number one bestseller list.
No, he
until
had not,
then.
And that's nothing on him. I mean, he was still a pretty wildly successful author.
Right, right.
But he hadn't had a hardcover number one until the first book we did, which it was actually First to Die.
Yeah.
And from that point on, he's had nothing but number ones. But I'm not, you know, I think he brings something to the table himself. He's had a number of co-writers, as everyone knows, and he still managed to, you know, make the books all get to the same point. So,
yeah.
But it worked for both of us. And I think I'm the only one of the people he's paired up with who's sort of went off and done decently on his own. And you know, so it worked for both of us.
Yeah, interesting. I read that you said it was like an MFA and an MBA rolled into one.
Yeah,
experience,
well, that's what I say, because everyone says, well, what's it like to work with Jim? And that's, you know, I learned what I would call the rudiments of not only, you know, writing a successful suspense novel, but marketing it as well. And at the same time, I don't really write Patterson clones. I've sort of have taken from him what it is that I thought he does well, and there's a bunch of things, and put it into my own voice, in my own style, and in my own texture as a writer. You know, and so I, you know, like anything, you sort of learn and pick out what works for you. And so while my books do sort of thrive on pace, I don't know that they're quite Pattersonian, where the chapters are no more than 2 or 3 pages. And,
right, right. No, you definitely have your own voice, and you definitely, I mean, you are a success in your own right, regardless of, you know, how you got there in the beginning. But I want to talk about your book, Eyes Wide Open. You mentioned earlier that your nephew committed suicide. He was bipolar. You say the book's your brief anthem of remembrance to a life that didn't turn out as anyone had hoped. Reminds you that you could have done a lot more. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I mean, I came from my family, like the family in this book, actually has a lot of divorces around it. So I didn't grow up with either my brother, and I wasn't particularly close to this nephew who ended up having this tragic end. At the same time, it reminds me constantly how much more I could have tried to have done, how much more we in the family could have done to give this guy a little more of a protective nest than we had done. You know, so, you know, as a writer, what can I do except build a story around him? And what I've wanted to do in this book is take someone that was really sort of an unstable kid, and certainly begins the novel as, you know, a crazed young man, and sort of give him a dignity and I think a spirit of grace in the end that he didn't have. And what this novel really is about is 2 brothers. One of them successful, the other a wayward child of the 60s, and their life has taken them down different roads in life. And really, it's a story of this suicide that may not be a suicide, and one of them goes out west to try and sort of pick up clues, and he begins to pick up clues that maybe this suicide wasn't exactly what it seems, and the other one, for reasons in the book, wants to keep everything a secret and is terrified of his own past coming back against him. So that's sort of what this is, what it's about. So it's a personal family story. There's tons of my own family lore in this book, and you know, anyone who knows me is sort of it almost reads like a memoir with a lot of thrills and reversals.
Right. Definitely a lot of dynamics in there. The family, as you said, and choices and taking different paths. We're almost at the end of our segment. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Andrew?
I think people who want a book, my books, I think, are generally sort of hard to put down. I think it's the kind of, I like to write books like Jim that you can read in two or three sittings that get you involved in the reader's plight from the opening pages and won't let you go until it's done. And they're very family-oriented thrillers, meaning they're not PG necessarily, but that they really revolve around families and family dynamics, and I think have a lot of emotional content. So like the author before, I'll leave you with my website if you're interested in my stuff, andrewgrossbooks.com. So take a peek and let me know if you guys buy it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Okay, pleasure.
The New York Journal of Books said that Andrew's book is exhilarating and intricately plotted top-notch thriller, and it certainly was a fast read. Eyes Wide Open is the name of the book. Andrew Gross, my guest, and you can find out more about Andrew and his work at andrewgrossbooks.com. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be back next week. Happy Labor Day, I should say, for next week. We will be back with a rebroadcast next week. Until then, live well, live strong.